This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, we've heard a lot about journalism's best, how intrepid reporters at the Washington Post uncovered Watergate and brought down a president. Much of the more recent news about journalism has not been so good. In the past couple of years, scandal visited the New York Times, CBS News, USA Today, and Newsweek magazine, among others. Stories were stolen, fabricated, and attributed to what turned out to be unreliable sources. We're a long way from the halcyon days of Watergate, when journalists were the kings of cool, and opinion polls reflect that. Readers and listeners distrust the media more than ever. In an effort to restore their profession's reputation, five leading journalism schools announced plans to revamp their programs. Together, schools like Columbia, Northwestern, and Harvard will spend $6 million to prepare aspiring journalists for a changing media environment and declining interest in the news. Later in the program, new web domains, including one for pornography, plus we'll remember Basketball Hall of Famer George Mikan, who died earlier today. But first, Journalism 101. What does it take to build a better reporter? Is it good schooling, experience in the field, better ethics? If you're a skeptic, what does the media have to do to restore your confidence? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism is one of the J schools that's changing what it teaches its students. Lauren Guglione is the dean of Northwestern's program, and he's with us from a studio at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois. And it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil.
What's being changed and why?
Well, a number of things are being changed, not all just, by the way, to restore reputation, although that's important. But, you have the technological change, you have economic issues of publicly traded companies being very profit-oriented and not necessarily investing what they should, we think, in the news operations. So it goes beyond credibility, but we've made it a requirement that students at Medill, for example, sign an integrity pledge and to abide by our integrity policy before we even allow them into the school or they can enroll. Then my first meeting with the students at the beginning of the year is devoted to plagiarism and other ethical issues. And we have a faculty on stage that talks about the ethical issues in photojournalism and images. And then we talk about words. And you'd be surprised how many students coming out of high school do not know what plagiarism is, and that surveys suggest that somewhere between 75 to 94% of high school students, depending upon the survey, acknowledge that they cheated in high school.
Mm-hmm. Once they figure out what it is. Now, this sounds like it's been in the works for a while.
Yes. Actually, this initiative has began 3 years ago with conversations among the five institutions. And I think it's just it may be a reflection of how universities work, but I suspect a reflection of the real world, that part of the innovation is just having five schools agree to work together instead of competing with one another.
Well, it certainly got more splash than five individual announcements. But I wonder, what do you make of the declining reputation of journalists? To some degree, it seems to be deserved.
Well, I think it's part of the societal. You mentioned business schools. I think every institution in society has experienced the same declining percentages of belief in credibility. And there's a great deal of skepticism out there, and some of it, indeed, based on the examples you cited, is deserved. And we're doing our best to make sure that we change it as much as we can. And I think there are other factors. There's a more partisan, polarized culture, and so the media bashing occurs very high profile within the media itself regularly. Sort of oversimplification as to who the villain is, whether it's liberal media bias or whatever. And, the wonderful blogs are wonderful, and they're not so good. So the wonderful part is that people can correct errors quickly or point them out, and that, I think, in the long term will be a great benefit. The news organizations are much more careful about reporting corrections, for example, so people see that we make mistakes, we are human. So I think there's probably an unreasonable expectation about journalists that they can somehow, just if they work hard enough, be completely accurate and fair. But we have to set high expectations for ourselves, that's for sure.
As I understand, part of this mission is also to boost the profile of J-schools like yours to make you and your colleagues a bigger part of the discourse surrounding these issues.
That's correct, and also have an important role in distinguished research universities so that we take advantage of all the other parts of the other units of the university. So we've introduced specialized reporting programs in law, legal reporting, and religion reporting, and business reporting that draw upon the Kellogg School of Management and other units at Northwestern. And we hope not only training students in the craft, but in knowing more about their fields will help increase the sophistication of the reporting and make for greater accuracy, too.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. We're talking with Lauren Giglione, the Dean of Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and Kate joins us on the line from Liberty, Missouri.
Hi, I'm a graduate of the Journalism School at University of Kansas, and I took ethics before it was a requirement at the school. And I found it difficult when I became a working journalist to actually kind of follow through on a lot of those things I have learned.
Give me an instance.
Well, I worked for a trade publication, and something simple as accepting free food, free items from a vendor, from a person we were covering, and you know, even the little things. And I wonder how journalists who didn't take ethics, again, it was an elective at my school at the time, could even start to have that kind of ethical guideline. Mm-hmm. You know, if they hadn't even spent the time talking through these things, how difficult it was when you had to keep on task and to remember these things.
Lauren Giglione,
yes.
The guarantee for press attendance at your conference is free food.
Well, actually, it's an interesting example. We just had an ethics panel with I think five representatives from different parts of journalism media, and that free food issue was raised, and disturbingly, there was disagreement among the panelists as to whether free food was acceptable or not. My hope is that more of the companies will move toward what the Chicago Tribune presented, which was an ethics code and a policy about conflicts of interest, a written code that one has to sign when one becomes an employee, and the rules are written out and quite clear. And I would hope that we would move toward that kind of that sort of obviousness, if you will. And then second, I would say that we've learned that the real world does present ethical challenges, and so we put our ethics and law course after the junior year teaching media internship experience that students have to do at Medill when they go out and work for newspapers and magazines and television stations, because we find they have a lot of questions after they've been out in that real world.
Yep. Kate, thanks very much. Are you still in the business, by the way?
No, I've been. I'm a mom, and I help administrate a church. So I'm working with ethics every day.
Okay. Good luck. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
I wonder, Lauren Giglione, where did you learn your journalism?
Well, I learned it the old-fashioned non-journalism school way, and I'm afraid I edited the college paper at Haverford College outside of Philadelphia, interned at a weekly in California, the Claremont Courier, and then interned at the Washington Post, and then my wife and I bought a small newspaper when we were still in our 20s, and that was our dream.
So the old apprenticeship model of journalism.
That's correct. It's a very different model. But I would say that all of us, the five schools are represented by people who didn't have the advantage of a journalism school education. We feel today that given the changes in the fields, in the field and what's happening in terms of what you need to know in specialized areas, that a journalism school really has a lot to offer that we couldn't get from our experiences.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jack, and Jack is with us from Oahu.
Well, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Yes, I attended the University of Montana School of Journalism back in the mid-70s, and even though ethics wasn't directly addressed, we were taught to be fair and unbiased.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you go to college, you come out with an idealistic attitude, and you know you learn how you're supposed to do things, but once you get out into the real world, then economics starts dictating which way you got to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, the people who own your newspaper or your media may be directing which direction you're supposed to go.
Especially small town papers, do you think?
Definitely.
Yeah, Lauren Guglione, a lot of people like Jack find that the real world is quite different from the ideals that they learned in journalism school.
Well, I can't dispute that. The real world is the real world. But I do think it makes a difference in terms of where you set your own personal boundaries. We all have choices to make and who will be our employer and if we will work for someone. And so I think journalism schools have to take the high road and train people toward an ideal and be a conscience of journalism. I know at Montana, for example, there was a journalism review. It was a very early one, and I thought it was distinguished and played an important role in saying this is the way it should be, and these media are not abiding by the standards of the profession. So we have to be a conscience, and there's no other course that I think a journalism school that really cares can take.
Jack?
Well, the schools do their best, and it sounds like they're taking steps to get even better. And I always was happy to be, you know, to have attended there. And we can only hope things get better.
Okay, Jack. And are you still in the journalism business?
No, sir. I'm a welding inspector.
Well, ethics are just as important in welding, too. Jack, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Dean Guglione, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Lauren Guglione is dean at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and he was kind enough to join us today from a studio on the campus of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. We're talking about what young journalists need to know. What do you think is most important to teach new reporters and editors? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Like many other professions, journalism has become increasingly, well, professional. Few work their way up from copy boy to senior editor anymore. Now it's a journalism degree and a couple of competitive internships that get you inside the door. In the face of all this, five of the country's top journalism schools are reassessing the education they give the next generation of journalism. That, of course, following scandals in the newspaper and broadcasting businesses. We're talking about what young journalists should know. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or email us, totn@npr.org. Ed Bradley is a stalwart in the news business, correspondent as well as co-editor of CBS Television's 60 Minutes. He began his career with CBS more than 30 years ago. Ed Bradley joins us now by phone from his office in New York City. Very nice of you to be with us today.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
You've won, I think, every award there is to win in journalism, yet you attended, as I understand, Cheney State College in Pennsylvania and got a degree in education.
Right. I not only got a degree in education, but taught school for 3.5 years.
Was that a good apprenticeship for journalism, do you think?
I don't make any connection between the two, because I think what I learned about journalism, I learned in the School of Hard Knocks.
And
in my first job, I learned how to do this. I never had a course in journalism, so I had to learn it by doing it. And sometimes I think that's the best way to do it.
A lot of people who went to the School of Hard Knocks would agree with you.
Yeah, I think that having the opportunity to go out and cover a story, you learn a lot more about how to do that than sitting in a classroom and having some professor tell you how to cover a story.
Because it's real-world experience, and you have to come back with a story and hand it to an editor who is going to take a pencil out and make confetti out of it.
Right. And the difference, I think, is I think it may also be generational, because I think that with my generation and older people, most of us came into this business, at least television and radio, by accident, by starting out in a small station somewhere rather than by starting in a journalism school. And I would say the same thing is true for a lot of print people. I was reading Bob Woodward's story today in the Washington Post about Deep Throat and found out that, Woodward came out of the Navy as a second lieutenant and was thinking about going to law school and instead started at the Washington Post, and they told him after 2 weeks, you can't do this. And he went to a small weekly paper in Virginia and learned how to be a reporter. He didn't learn it in school.
Yet after all of the experiences that we've seen, you know, those stories that damaged CBS News and the New York Times and other institutions, ethics, where did you learn ethics?
From my mother.
And that's the toughest school of all.
You know, I think that you have an internal compass that... you come to the table with that internal compass. And then I think that there is a sense of ethics at the organization where you work. And I think it varies from organization to organization. And I think within an organization, it can change over the years. But when I came to CBS, there was a sense of this is how we do this, and we don't do this. And you learn that not just from doing it, but from observation and watching other people. Because when I first came to CBS, I didn't get on the air very much. When I went to Washington from after Vietnam in 1974, you know, there were 26 reporters and correspondents in Washington, and I was number 26.
Who did you watch?
Oh, you know, I grew up watching nationally. Walter Cronkite, and as someone who was not just an anchorman, but was a reporter, and I love the documentaries that Walter used to do, and how he put himself in the documentaries, not just asking questions, but sometimes getting involved and how this felt. I remember one piece he did in the early days of the space age in this country, where he went through a portion of the training that astronauts do. And it, you got a sense of, well, hey, this is a guy who's not an astronaut, who's not going to space, and this is how it feels. I could get how it felt from my perspective because I was more like Walter than I was like an astronaut.
I wonder... You see the new kids coming in. They've all gone to journalism school and had the internships and the new way of doing things. These days, do you see the necessity to write that unwritten code down, as the journalism dean was telling us before you joined us?
I think it's imperative. I mean, we have a book that sits on my desk next to my keyboard that's called the CBS News Standards. And it's not something that I read every day. But it's something that, after all of these years at being at CBS, is ingrained in me. But it is something that when I received my first copy, I read to see what I could do and what I couldn't do. And some things were very small, and you would think, well, what's the harm in doing that? And it was said, well, we just don't do that. That's staging something. I remember someone saying about a door that was revolving in a story that I shot in my early years at 60 Minutes. Did you spin that door? Well, no. Somebody came out of the door, and we were shooting, and we only used the portion of the empty door spinning. Well, you know, it seems sort of nonsensical. Why couldn't you spin a door if you wanted to use that as a shot? But we had someone who said, you can't do that.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Richard. Richard's calling us from Bishop, California.
Yes, Neil. Really value your program.
Thank you.
I wanted to make a general comment.
Go ahead.
And that comment was that I think an unfettered press is critical to the survival of a democracy, and currently I don't think the general press is being very critical of our politicians and our government. And I think maybe the primary ingredient is the mixing of profit and the function of the press. And I just wondered what your speaker thinks about that commingling of profit and unfettered search for information that I think is so critical to a democracy.
Richard, thanks very much for the question. Ed Bradley, 60 Minutes is one of the most important journalistic outlets in the country. It's also one of CBS Television's most profitable.
And I think that there is a delicate balance between the two. And I think that there is a line that we try not to cross, and at the same time try to remain still a viable, popular, and thus profitable broadcast. Because if you're not, you're not going to be on the air, as evidenced by what happened to 60 Minutes Wednesday,
yeah,
which finished near the bottom of the ratings. And was killed by CBS. Won't be on the air next year. There were some good reporters over there who did some good work. They did have problems with one piece in particular, but in my sense, that's not enough to kill the broadcast. But when the ratings are bad and the network is looking to squeeze every dime they can out of the bottom line, that's what you face. I think that what we have to realize is that the news business today is not what it was 25, 35, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think when William Paley started this company, and for the years when CBS ruled the roost, his attitude was that he made money from I Love Lucy and the other programs he had on in prime time, and that the news division was his gift to the American people. It was a public service, not something that he expected to make money on. And I think that radically changed with the advent of 60 Minutes, because 60 Minutes became wildly popular, reached number one in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, the first broadcast to do that,
mm-hmm.
Still finishes in the top 20. Far ahead of any other news program, and still makes money for this company. So that you have a corporate shift in that you don't have someone who sits there as Mr. Paley did and say, I'm not interested in making money from this news division. The news division today is like any other division. It's expected to earn its way. And that does bring pressure to bear on the people who run the division.
Ed Bradley, thank you so much for joining us. We know you're busy. We appreciate your time today.
Neil, thank you for having me.
Ed Bradley, correspondent for the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes, also the show's co-editor, and he joined us by phone from his office in New York City. With us here in Studio 3A is Tom Rosenstiel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And Tom, listening to Ed Bradley and some of the callers as well, a lot of this comes down to money.
Yes, it does. And Ed's right that the expectations for journalism have changed. When you look at the public polling data that goes back about 20 years and you boil it all down, what the public feels is that increasingly the press is motivated by an economic agenda rather than a public interest agenda, and that individual journalists do what they do to advance their careers. And increasingly in the last 5 years or so, surveys of journalists find that they agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, that attitude by the public is a rational response to changes that have occurred in the news business. Ed's right that starting in the mid-1980s, the networks began to expect their news divisions to turn a profit, beginning in about the late 80s and early 90s, newspapers made a big push to become much more efficient, to focus more on their stock prices. A lot of this is a reflection of new technology. There's a lot more competition out there. It's harder to make money. When CBS controlled 90% of the – when the networks controlled 90% of the TV audience, frankly, they didn't have to expect their news divisions to make a profit. But – we are in the news business are to some extent hoisted on our own petard. We told people, you know, we're a public interest, and now we behave less like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're more sensitive to shareholder equity and our fiduciary responsibilities to that constituency, and we're suffering the backlash from that.
We also told our readers and listeners, trust us, we have mechanisms, these stories are checked, these are accurate, and after all of these scandals over the past few years, a lot of people in the journalism business think they're aberrations. A lot of people in public, at least according to opinion surveys, think this is just the tip of the iceberg.
I think one of the things that's going on is that there's a cultural shift, really, that goes beyond news, but it hits squarely in the news. We've left the age of trust me journalism, and we've entered the age of show me journalism. The press needs to be much more transparent, and the level of proof that we have to expect of ourselves as journalists has to be higher now than it used to be.
We're talking about building a better reporter. What should journalism do to repair its tattered reputation? Our guest is Tom Rosensteel. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Daniel's with us. Daniel calling from Berkeley, California.
Yeah. I think one of the problems that I see in reading the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, which are the papers I read, is that part of the problem is under-editing or no editing. If you look at the corrections the New York Times publishes every day, many of them seem to be really embarrassing. You know, the large country immediately south of Pakistan is India, not China. Things which any high school graduate could pick up, and it almost looks like stuff's going in the paper without any editing process at all. And this, you know, makes me lose confidence in their commitment to getting correct information in the paper in the first place.
Tom Rosensteel, are newspapers correcting, have more mistakes to correct, or are they correcting more mistakes?
Yes and yes. It's a little of both. I mean, the technology is such now that computers... it's easier to sort of paginate a page and get things into the paper. You don't have to have a human being literally typeset a story the way that you used to, and those people were required to know certain things. There were multiple layers of editors because the technology required it, and the technology no longer does. The educational system is part of this. Speed is part of this. As the news cycle accelerates, accuracy diminishes. Speed is almost always the enemy of accuracy. And then you've got the fact that the expectations about correcting things are higher than they used to be, and there are more corrections in the newspaper because papers think that that's expected of them now.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
If the profession of journalism is changing, how does that affect who's in the newsroom? Joining us now by phone from his office in Detroit, Michigan, is Joe Grimm, Recruiting and Development Director for the Detroit Free Press. Thanks very much for being with us.
And thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure.
As a recruiter for your paper, where do you go to find new talent? Do you go to journalism schools?
Well, it's kind of funny. We're talking about this coalition of five journalism schools, and it just so happens I've been to three of them already this year recruiting. So I hit some of those schools. Of course, I go to local schools and try to pick up students in places other than schools, at job fairs and things like that. So we're always looking close to home and around the country.
Well, how important is it that somebody attend journalism school?
It can be very helpful for them in terms of some of the things we're talking about, ethics and integrity, are maybe best taught in a formal place like a journalism school. You won't pick this up in the English program. But it is not essential that one studies journalism to be successful as a journalist, and it's probably not great for the newsroom if everybody in the newsroom came from the same place.
So you want to bring in people with a variety of different experiences, lawyers and longshoremen.
Absolutely. And we have people here who studied chemistry, English, actuarial science, politics, and because all these subjects go into our newspaper, we have use for all of those knowledge of all of those fields.
Would you say that most, if not all of them, have gone to college?
Most have gone to college. Not every one of them has graduated. We have one who's working, a couple who are working now to complete their degrees. Some of them simply started working in journalism before they had graduated.
Do you think the types of people interested in journalism has changed over the years?
I think it has. I think journalism has become much more of a business, much more, I think, conforming is valued more than it used to be valued. I think it used to be, there used to be more wild and strange people in journalism than we have now, I think.
That used to be some people you'd point out.
I beg your pardon?
Those people used to develop into stars, a lot of them.
Well, in a lot of cases.
Or they got fired pretty quickly.
Well, it becomes a chicken and egg question, maybe.
Sometimes they got fired, then they became stars somewhere else.
That's right. Or were they crazy until we turned them that way?
Joe Grimm, thanks very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Joe Grimm is a recruiting and development director for the Detroit Free Press and joined us by phone from his office in Detroit, Michigan. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation about how to build a good reporter. And we'll also talk about a new internet domain, includes one for pornography.xxx. And we'll remember basketball great George Mikan, who died earlier today. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation on how to train journalists. The aftermath of scandals at various print and broadcast outlets, and the announcement by five of the country's leading journalism schools that they propose to change the way they train aspiring journalists and editors. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Our guest is Tom Rosensteel, and Tom is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Scott. Scott's with us from Watertown, New York.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well.
I'm the news director of a small family-owned TV station.
Yes.
And I have a couple of points I'd like to make. I hire a lot of young journalists, and generally it's their first job out of journalism school, most frequently Syracuse University. And there's two things I'd like to see. One's technical and one's philosophical. Technically, I think we've got to get to the point where we view whatever the stories of the day are as just the stuff of journalism. I find it hard to do, but I'd love to be able to hire people who can write like aces, can pick up a camera and make reasonably good pictures, and can turn around and put something on the internet. It's a skill that's underdeveloped in journalism schools. So, I'm not sure that those things are as far apart as J schools say they are. Philosophically,
and so just following up, insufficient practical experience is what you're saying.
Insufficient practical experience, but along with it, it can't be a trade school. It has to be viewed as a calling. And I don't mean that in the, sort of the Benedictine sense. I guess I mean it more in the Hunter S. Thompson, we need mad monks. We need the kind of people that the fellow from the Detroit News was talking about, people who are at least a little bit crazed on the idea of going out and doing this. Otherwise, you end up with sort of assembly line news, of which there's an awful lot in this country.
And do you find kids in journalism schools with that kind of passion these days?
Yeah, well, I find some kids with passion without the technical skills. I find some kids with the technical skills without the passion. And very, very rarely I find that gem of a human being who just wants to rip it up.
Tom Rosensteel, the calling part of journalism, again, it can be easily over-exaggerated, but do you think Scott's got a point?
Yeah, and, it's one of the things that as you professionalize a craft, you lose. Schools sort of stamp people in the same way that law schools and medical schools try and do, and some of that gets stamped out of people. There's a famous essay about by a sociologist from the 1950s about how journalism standards evolve, and he said it happens by osmosis as people go, the way Ed Bradley described, go to an organization and they find out what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and there's sort of this won't get in the newspaper, this won't get on the show. But that's a little different than shaping how you're supposed to think, which is more what a school does. And so one of the sort of trade-offs here is you don't have as motley a crew if you're getting them from an institution of higher learning.
Mm-hmm. Scott, and if you're hiring a lot of kids from Syracuse, at least they're not surprised when spring fails to arrive in Watertown, New York.
Spring, what's that?
Appreciate it, Scott.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Ellen. Ellen's with us from Kansas City.
Hello.
Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a 1986 graduate of newspaper journalism from the University of North Dakota, and I left the field shortly thereafter. But what I want to talk about is the whole process of McNews. I remember in my senior year, one of my professors walked into class, and USA Today had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you guys forget about it. It's over. It's all just going to be, and she called it McNews that day. I mean, even before anybody else came up with that term.
Mm-hmm.
And here's to Zena Bethlehem, and I hope she's listening. And then I went on, I worked in a small town newspaper, and then I got hired by a wire service. And I was limited to 250 words for an in-depth story. And so it just became he said, she said. And I found with the advent of 24-hour news, that's just gotten worse. And how do you train students to take the time to verify their facts et cetera, et cetera, and also provide context for the consumers.
Yeah, and
it's just so missing.
Tom Rosenstiel, is the problem, well, certainly ethics is a problem, but is McNew is also a problem?
Yeah, you know, I think the callers really touched on something significant, and that is that the dirty little secret of the information revolution is that a lot of it is about repackaging other people's information. It's about synthesizing. It's not actually about reporting, going out and finding things
exactly.
out. That really encourages the McNews. And then corporations who run these companies say, you know, we don't really need people who have all these other skills because what they're doing is hooking paragraphs or, you know, processing stuff. News is information is a commodity. It's in oversupply. Let's stamp it. Let's make it fast food. Let's make sure it's the same at every one of our papers because then we have quality control. It's easier. That corporate mindset, it all leads to that. And in a sense, what journalists need to do to serve citizens is fight against those larger trends that are cultural and technological. And that's a tough call. That's a tough order.
Alan, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Tom Rosenstiel, thanks for coming in today, as always.
My friend.
Tom Rosenstiel is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and he joined us here in Studio 3A.